Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Victor Stater, the J. and Lucas Tequaman Professor in the Department of History at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to talk about his new book, Hoax, The Papist Plot That Never Was, out this year, 2022, with Yale University Press. Hello, Victor, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for joining me. So how are you this morning? How are things in Louisiana?
Well, today actually is a special day because it is the day that the first cold front has dragged its ass through Baton Rouge. So we're all quite happy.
What does a cold front look like in Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
The first one usually looks pitifully weak. The low temperature today is, I think, 64. So, but it means that we won't be in the 90s today. And
yeah, that sounds.
The humidity is below 90%. So everybody's delighted.
Yeah, that sounds quite nice. I 90s in September sounds sounds probably pretty southern, actually. There we are. All right. Well, I'm talking to you from a cold and rainy Amsterdam, as expected. All right. So I'm looking through, you know, your career here and your publications, and you're the author of Duke Hamilton is Dead, Aristocratic Life and Death in Stuart Britain and Noble Government, The Stuart Lord Lieutenancy and the Transformation of English Politics, and various other articles and essays that are basically on politics, the history of politics, government, the elite, and power in early modern England. That's a fair characterization of your interests. Yeah, very much.
In some ways, this book is a continuation of themes that I talk about going as far back as my dissertation, which I finished in 1988. So. I'm a one-trick pony, I guess.
I think we call that a dedicated and focused scholar.
Okay.
That's a term we like. But I mean, in some ways, this is also a very different. This is a different book than you've done before, and it's very much a political story. But there's a lot of pop culture, and it's used broadly, there's a lot of. There's a popular, I get a lot of the zeitgeist in this book. It also is just, man, it's a good story. It's a really good, and it's one that I hadn't heard. Were you familiar with this before you started working on this book?
Oh, yes. The Popish Plot, as it's known to those of us in the know, is something that pretty much everyone who works in the field knows a good deal about it. I decided to write the book though, because it even though people know about it, professional historians have a tendency to sort of assume that everybody is familiar with it. And when they write their books, they sort of blast through it without taking much time. And what I wanted to do was explore it in much greater detail. And I also feel like it had a more significant long-term impact than it has been given credit for. The other thing is that it's a book that's in a way in homage to the historian who last wrote about the plot, John Kenyon, back in the early 1970s, a magnificent book, but no one's published on it directly since. And that was the book that drew me into the study of the English Restoration.
Oh, fascinating. Okay. So this also has a lot of personal resonance for you.
It does. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you've been sitting with for a while. So when you decided to take a look at this, you obviously there's a good deal of secondary literature you look at. What's your primary and contemporary source base?
Well, probably the most important are the published records of the trials, that and parliamentary records, the journals of both the House of Commons and the House of Lords. But we do have these wonderful collections of what are called state trials that give verbatim testimony from the law courts. And were collected together and published in the early 19th century. And there must be dozens of volumes of these collected together. And they're really a wonderful source because you can really get a feel for what was actually happening in the walls of the courthouse.
Yeah, a lot of, and description, I mean, these first person voices, right? You hear what people are saying, and court reporters are what they are, but very clearly, you're getting fairly unfiltered information here.
Right. And it's, we know pretty much, that these are fairly accurate. We can't be 100% sure that everything that gets written down was what was said, but we know that there were multiple people taking notes. We know that the judges frequently reviewed the text before it was published. So we can have fairly high confidence that these records are pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested as well in kind of, this is one of the things that English history is famous for, these great, like you have these really good sources, right? You have these excellent court records, and people who are interested in doing more kind of gender stuff have the Old Bailey as well. Like there's really good records. But can you tell our listeners a little bit about what goes into a trial? Who's there? How famous is this? Like what's happening around this courtroom?
Most of the important cases were tried in the Old Bailey, which is the Central Criminal Court. It's still the Old Bailey, different building now, but it was a public trial. One of the things which is very interesting and which I didn't know before I did the research for this is the configuration of the Old Bailey is fascinating. The courtroom was on the ground floor of the building, which had originally burned down in the Great Fire of 1666. And so it was rebuilt and it was pretty new when these trials took place. The courtroom on the ground floor was open to the air. So there were three sides that had walls, and then the long side facing the street was actually open.
Wow.
And there was a courtyard there, so spectators could just pile into that open space to witness the trial. So you could have hundreds of people there watching the proceedings. Within the court itself, there was a raised dais where the judges sat. There was a box where the jury sat, and then a place, a box for the defendant as well. So it was all open and public, and very difficult at times to control because the crowd could get a little overexcited, and they had to have officers of the court there with rods to sort of maintain some semblance of order when things got hectic. But the ideal was that this was to be a public trial and ordinary people had the right to witness them.
Which is fascinating, right? So when we talk about the impact of this trial, it's not just on a small number of people. It's not just going to be, this isn't just something that affects the elites or the machinations of government. This is a very public, massive spectacle.
That's right.
These
cases were followed religiously by hundreds of thousands of people, and London basically ground to a halt while these trials went on. And there was a whole industry revolving around the publication of the texts of the testimony, of prints and broadsides depicting the famous figures in the trials, some of the informers, and the like. It was big business, the London tradesmen really were very quick to cash in on everything surrounding the plot. I mean, there's a whole range of commercial kitsch that comes out of it. Playing cards, stove tiles, just an amazing array of publications, medals, just you name it, and somebody in London was manufacturing it and selling it. There were even daggers, souvenir daggers being sold. It was quite the opportunity for shrewd businessmen.
That is, that's really, that makes sense. I don't know why am I even a little bit shocked that there are people selling souvenir daggers. We have, as you're talking about this plot that is this really important political affair that then has really important ramifications. And I think it's kind of, it reflects in the kind of book you've written a little. And one more thing before we get into the specifics of the case, this is a really readable book. So it's smart. It's an excellent, well-researched, well-written, solidly defended historical argument, but it's also just good fun. It's really, it's well-written. It's the narrative driven. It has the opportunity, or I think it could be a very, like a popular, this could appeal to a popular audience. Was that intentional?
Yeah. I wanted to write a book that people would like to read. And the last book that I did was similar in that aim. I feel like part of my obligation as a historian is to write things for a broader audience. And I don't think that we academic historians should cede the field entirely to the popularizers, who I have nothing against, but I think sometimes we get on the academic side a little too stuffy and boring.
And we're encouraged to speak only to each other, right? We're encouraged to write these books. We write that for other historians who do exactly what we do. Yeah, and I mean, nothing against a journalist, but it's really nice to read a history book that's written by a professional historian that's a good story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it was certainly fun to do. It was every every day when I'd go into the archive, or later when, you know, when we were locked out of archives, when I logged on to the Hathi Trust, which was a godsend for anybody who's was trying to do real history during the pandemic. There was just every day there was another bunch of great stories and remarkable chicanery and you name it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of chicanery. There's some remarkable chicanery here. Yeah, I would say there's also some skullduggery and perhaps some shenanigans.
Right. Yeah. All of those. One of the things which I think is a pretty apparent when you read the book is that in many ways politicians and politics were as egregious then as they are now, if not more so. Then actually the stakes were higher. People ended up being unjustly executed. So, but politicians are they don't come off super well in this story.
No, they do not. Well, let's step back. Let's take a minute. And if you would please tell our listeners, what is the Popish plot?
Okay. Well, the Popish plot was an invention dreamed up by initially two informers, one of whom was half mad, a paranoid minister of the Church of England. The other, the more important of whom, was a serial pederast, liar, perjurer. He had been basically chased out of every living and place of employment he'd ever been in for misbehavior. These two came up with a story in which they claimed that there was a Roman Catholic conspiracy to assassinate King Charles II. The goal there was to put Charles's brother and heir apparent, James, Duke of York, onto the English throne, because James was a Catholic convert. And the story had resonance with many people because of the longstanding fear and hatred that Catholicism inspired in England. There's the failed attempt to blow up Parliament and the royal family in 1605 is one of the chapters in that long story. The failed attempt to invade England by the Spanish and the Spanish Armada. There are any number of reasons why a perfectly rational English person in 1678 would believe that there was such a conspiracy. So when these two informers brought the news of this alleged plot to the authorities, there was a willingness to believe that there could be something there. And so it triggered an investigation. The investigation reveals something which many people were very shocked by, which was that there is, or there was at the time, a very broad and very well disguised Catholic underground in England and in London in particular. It was illegal to practice Catholicism, and there were any number of laws on the books that were intensely persecutory. So Catholics developed over the course of a century all sorts of dodges and strategies which kept them out of sight. And nobody had for years really bothered to to try to dig out the Catholic underground. And so they started doing it, and they discovered, my God, there's a Benedictine monastery in the middle of London. There are Jesuits all over the place. So this reinforces the people's fear of Catholics. And then to top it off, the magistrate who was originally the man who took the information from our two informers, a man named Titus Oates and Israel Tung, this magistrate was murdered, or everyone assumed he was murdered. Edmund Godfrey was the magistrate. He took the depositions of our two anti-heroes and then disappeared. His corpse was found a week later. The immediate assumption was, oh no, the Catholics have murdered Magistrate Godfrey. Well, they found the body with a sword stuck in it, with ligature marks around his neck. So he did not die a natural death. In fact, the historian Alan Marshall has written a book in which he investigates the death of Godfrey very, very closely. And his conclusion, which I think is quite right, very plausible to me, is that Godfrey, who was known to be something of a depressive, probably hanged himself. And his two brothers, who stood to lose their inheritance because Godfrey was single, his brothers were his heirs, and the property of a suicide is forfeit to the crown. The likelihood is that the two brothers discovered their dead brother and thought, oh no, we're going to lose the entirety of his estate, so let's make it look like a murder. They concealed the body for a while. They then stuck a sword into it and dumped it on the outskirts of London. When it was discovered, all hell broke loose because everyone assumed that, you know, this is more proof of this giant plot. And at that very moment, a new session of Parliament opened. And in that Parliament were a number of highly ambitious and unscrupulous politicians who intended to use this so-called plot as a stick to beat their political enemies in the government with. And so you get this uncontrollable crisis that emerges out of these almost random acts that expands to effectively take over the political world for the next year or so, and which has the long-term impact of helping to create a two-party political system in England, which, of course, over the long term has incalculable consequences.
Continues to be quite important indeed. So we've got this whole, this is a mishigash, right? Murders, secret Catholics, possible suicide, kind of early modern insurance fraud, a possible attempted regicide, dirty politicians, like this whole shebang. And, you know, if you were writing this as fiction, I might question your ethics. I might like say, well, that's a little much there, right? Like, okay, you've gone too far here. But yet this is all truth. And people believe there's a conspiracy theory of epic proportion, and people believe it, right? People believe this. Contemporaries believe this.
They do. And it results in the arrest and prosecution of dozens of completely innocent Catholics. Probably, I think it's about two dozen who end up being executed. More die in jail before their opportunity to be tried. These trials were conducted in the shadow of a sort of a deep hatred of Catholics. And so getting a fair trial was not really on the program. I mean, people were simply, they assumed guilt before a word was spoken. And it was very difficult for the defendants in these cases to gain acquittal because of the assumption by both the judges and the juries involved that they were clearly guilty because they were Catholic.
Right, that they're guilty of something, whether it's flat or not.
The defendants. This was one of the things which really struck me in reading through the trial transcripts. The defendants were constantly being required to prove a negative. So there was no written evidence to demonstrate the existence of this plot at all. There were no letters, there were no diaries, there's nothing actually concrete. And the defendants would say, well, show us the evidence. Where did anybody write a letter? Is there an account book? Any actual evidence? And the response of the court was invariably, well, you destroyed it, obviously. Why would you keep those things if you were plotting the king's death? Well, how do you answer that?
Right.
So yeah. It was a series of shockingly unjust trials.
And so clearly we're looking at a political system that has not worked out all of its kinks, right? This is the trial system in England in the early modern period is not perfect.
Right, right. In cases that weren't as charged politically and religiously, it was possible to get a fair trial in an English court. But in this particular situation, these defendants were deeply disadvantaged from the very start.
And that has a lot to do. I mean, we can write a lot of that off to just anti-Catholic sentiment, but also a real paranoia, a real concern about the still 100 years later that England might become Catholic again.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about the contemporary situation in the late 1670s, this was a moment in which Louis XIV's France was pursuing an aggressively expansionist policy and persecuting French Protestants. So refugees were coming from France with horror stories about having their property destroyed and their homes invaded and on and on. And so in that context, it just deepens the fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in England, Europe, we have a situation where the monarchy, like the families, the ruling families are all deeply entwined. And places, you know, that it hasn't been that long since the Catholic Protestant shakeup happened. And so there's still a lot of fighting there. But then there's also just how much of this also reflects a political instability in this period, like a concern about the English crown.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a feature because many of these political divisions can be traced back to the period of the Civil War. And when skepticism begins to grow about the testimony of the various informers, as their stories get increasingly elaborate and hard to believe, that skepticism essentially divides along the same lines that the English people were divided upon during the Civil Wars. So those who are prone to a royalist outlook, people whose families had supported Charles I in the Civil Wars and who continue to support the royal family tend to be the skeptics. Mm-hmm. Whereas those who had stood on the other side tend to be, to continue to be believers, some sincerely, but there are a fair number, particularly among the leaders of the opposition, cynically, who although certainly realize that the plot is a fiction, but it's a useful fiction.
Mm. So this is another question I had. You open this book by talking about some modern conspiracy theories, right? Which it feels right now like we're in this heyday of conspiracy theories. But as an historian, I know that that's not the case. It's no worse now than it's ever been. But one of the, and so there's just some ideas about like what we can learn about how this works. But one thing that I'm struck by constantly with modern conspiracy theories on this as well is that question of who's a true believer? How many people really believe that there's a plot to overthrow the government and kill the king and replace him with the Catholic? And how many people are just along for the ride and they're using this because they know it's effective? Do you have any idea about that?
Well, my theory is that initially, with this concatenation of coincidence, the death of the magistrate and the revelations about the Catholic infrastructure of London, it was widely believed. I mean, there were some people who from the start knew for sure that this was a fiction, notably the king and his brother. But it was very broadly believed for about the first 3 months or so. After about 3 months, as the investigation gets progressively politicized by the opposition in Parliament, then you begin to see the growth of skepticism more broadly. And by the time 6 months had passed, the true believers were probably in a minority, but they were a loud and influential minority, and so they could push forward, for example, the trials of various Catholics, and they were quite sophisticated at spreading their version of the plot in print, through public demonstrations. There were all sorts of tricks in their bag that they used to impress on the broader population the reality, so-called, of this plot.
And then that's really useful for people who know, and there are a number of people who can use this sentiment to their own ends.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why it proves to be such an important political catalyst, because it pushes these the skeptics and the true believers into what turns into the first two ideologically driven political parties, the Whigs and the Tories. Whigs being the true believers, Tories being the skeptics. Now, I would hazard to say that two parties would have formed eventually anyway at some point. But it seems to me that the reaction to the plot is sort of what gets the ball rolling.
Okay. Yeah, so very long political responses ends to this. So what happens to these original two guys, your half-mad con men?
Well, Israel Tung is progressively sort of moved off the scene because he was half-mad and could not be reliably expected to learn his story. So he sort of fades out of the picture. Ultimately, he dies of what amounts to just old age. Now, Titus Oates, the other major informer, has a much more interesting story. He parlays this tale into international fame. There are German engravings, portrait engravings of him, for example. There are Dutch portrait engravings of him. International fame, a pension from the government, lodgings in the king's palace, and general adulation. Despite the fact that he was a truly horrible person, nobody liked him. Wherever he went, he made enemies. But his story was so gripping that none of that seemed to matter. Ultimately, the plot is largely revealed to be a sham. But this doesn't really happen in a decisive way until Charles II dies in 1685 and is replaced, for Titus Oates, by James, who had known all along that Oates was a fraud. So following Charles's death in James's reign, Oates was charged with perjury. He was also charged with libeling the king, as Duke of York. He got a massive fine for that. He was pilloried several times, and the sentence required him to be pilloried annually for the rest of his life, and he was jailed. But then, those of you who know your English history, James II ends up being deposed, at which point Titus Oates' narrative becomes very useful once again. And so he's released from prison. He's once again given a pension. He's now a hero again. But he was never content with what he had. And so he continued to make enemies wherever he went. But to the end of his life, he was a loathsome figure. I mean, he had first been raised as a dissenter, a Baptist during the Civil Wars. He had then become an Anglican minister. He had then become a Catholic. By the end of his life, he had gone back to the Baptist faith. But he used his religion for his own private interest. So in his final chapter as a Baptist, he effectively took over a Baptist chapel in London and milked it for cash. He married a woman despite the fact that he was not in that way inclined at all, and stole all her money. So he's just a terrible person, and if there is a hell, he was first in line. When he finally died in 1702, I think it was. And there are others. There's a whole cast of ne'er-do-wells and fraudsters and perjurers who emerge from the woodwork to try to get their own piece of fame and fortune. There's absolutely no shortage of truly reprehensible people who emerge from this story.
Sure. Yeah. And I feel like that's another kind of parallel we can see with our current political situation. There is no end to the number of people who are willing to do truly terrible things.
Yep. Human nature doesn't change. The times change, and circumstances change, but human nature is always the same, it seems to me.
It seems there are definitely always rotters, that is for sure. Just rarely do you have a situation that's such a perfect storm for them to really flourish. And this is a situation where it feels like many people's worst impulses were really...
Yeah, they come to the surface and are indulged by the times. It's you're very correct about that.
Yeah, and comeuppance seems to be in short supply in this situation as well.
Right, that's another thing. Their justice is not served very well in this story. It's sad, but that was the reality.
You know, it was a very politics is a high stakes game. It's that is just the situation.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a matter of life and death in many cases.
Yeah. In this way that I think is probably hard for modern people to wrap their brain around. So I've taken up quite a bit of your time, just a couple more things. So first of all, I just want to note for our listeners, you definitely want to read this book and the scholarly apparatus, the notes, but also the further reading section. There's a really nice, if you read this book and you're fascinated by it, you will find your way in this book to other really readable books about the period. Right, which it seems like you not only wanted to make sure your readers could enjoy this story, but if they wanted to, could really take a dive into the history.
Yeah, that's what I intended to do with that section on further reading. I didn't want to make it formal bibliography. If you want to know the sources, they're in the notes. But the further reading was meant as a way into the Restoration period, which I think is endlessly fascinating, and other people might find it so too.
I really think this book will find a good home with a lot of our listeners, and I think that our listeners will then be able to indulge their interests further. So I think you've provided a really nice entry into this period, and it's really nice. Well done. Yeah, thanks a lot. And it's the kind of book that I would love to see more of. I know... And people love history, not everyone. There are some people who just apparently don't like humans. But I mean, people love history, but they don't know necessarily how to read good history.
Yeah, and it's sometimes not real easy to figure out where you're going to find it. I mean,
reading a readable, a delightful narrative written well by a reputable and rigorous historian is a rarity, and you have made one. So well done. Thank you. So what's next? What are you working on now in your historian, book-lined historian's office?
Well, you know, I'm not sure yet. I mean, there are various ideas floating around my head, but I haven't settled on anything. It will be probably something in the late 17th century era. And I'm interested in all sorts of things, but I haven't decided just yet.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's exciting then. Just doing a lot of reading, poking around, seeing what you can find.
Something will leap out at me. And like this last book that I wrote, which was centered on an infamous duel that took place in the early 18th century, that story started out as me doing research into the union between England and Scotland. And I ran across this one figure who was a central person in that story. And it turns out he dies in a duel. And I decided that was way more interesting than the Treaty of Union, as important as it is. And so that's how that book got started. I'm hoping something like that will leap out at me for the next story.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to read everything you write. So please keep going. All right. Listeners, this has been a talk with Victor Stater about Hoax, the Papist Plot That Never Was, out this year, 2022, with Yale University Press. There's a link to purchase it on our website or find it wherever you like books. And Victor, thank you very much once again. Have a lovely night.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.